HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 55, recorded Monday, March 12th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott discusses Monorail with Aaron Jensen and Jacob Llewellyn of Alution Technologies.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, the podcast that doesn't waste your time. I'm sitting here with Aaron Jensen and Jacob Llewellyn from Alution Technologies. And we're going to talk about something wacky and crazy called Monorail. And I say that with the tongue placed firmly in cheek. But you know I'm an ASP.NET guy, and I wanted to hear about some of the alternative ways that people are building applications on ASP.NET. So we're going to talk about Monorail. So what is Monorail, and why should I care?
Well, maybe I should talk about why we switched off of web forms. So we started out doing web forms, and it worked. I mean, we actually looked at Monorail initially and decided, we don't really know what that is. Let's not really look into it. And so we started doing web forms. I mean, all the controls are available and magic happens with the view state and the postbacks. And we just kind of found as we were writing our pages that the view state was a bit heavier than we liked. So we looked into turning it off. So you can, you know, turn it off when you don't need it. And then we realized, oh, wait, there's still this control state. There's still these wacky IDs, you know, repeater underscore text box, et cetera, which makes doing any sort of Ajax or any sort of JavaScript on the client a lot more difficult. Just the whole postback mechanism in the view state just kind of killed us. I mean, it made things a lot more difficult than we liked, and combined with the fact that controls were rendered in ways we didn't like with span tags for labels. And I know now they have the new control rendering.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you, like, so the controls don't render that way and you can put in control adapters and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the control adapters, that's fairly new. And I think when we started, there was one available. So we didn't really ever look into those, but, we started looking into Monorail again, and the way Monorail works is it's just a lot easier to follow. Once you understand it, and essentially what it does is you set up a HTTP handler that is just a front controller that will take all of your .rails requests and forward them to an appropriate controller, a Monorail controller. So in Monorail, you've got three main things that are important: areas, controllers, and actions. And so a controller lives in an area. Area is kind of like a namespace. We wish it was tied to namespaces more.
Okay, so slow down. I'm not very clever. There's a HTTP handler that handles any extension that is a .rails extension. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you can probably have other things that live alongside. So you can have .foo and .aspx. But mm-hmm. .rails is the, you said the term front controller. So we're talking model view controller, model 3 type stuff. The kind of stuff that Java guys are used to, right?
Yeah.
Is it model view controller or is it just view controller?
It's model view controller. I mean, your model is your object model.
Okay. And so what are these terms, area, that you just said?
So area is like a namespace. It's a group of controllers. Most things live in the, you know, default area. But I mean, for example, we've got a student area, a teacher area, a manager area. And so like you'd have the student take test controller or the evaluation controller. And, that would live within the student area. It's just a grouping for controllers.
Okay. So if I'm going to put this in the terms that, like the Northwind database, right? You know, about like customers and orders and stuff. So I'd have a customer area, order area, stuff like that. But does that apply to the UI or does that apply to the model?
It's more to the UI. So, I mean, it's an area, what you see as a user, an area becomes a directory in your HTML. So if you're www.alution.com/student/placement/index.rails. And so, if you don't have the areas, then everything is, it would just be your controller name. So it allows you to break it into different directories. It's, It's just a maintainability aspect.
I'm still not following. Maybe you can help.
I think it's a minor thing, really. I mean, all you're doing is, like Aaron said, you're just providing a way to group controllers into, you know, areas where, you know, related controllers into an area. You know, under ASP, you can make new folders and put ASPXs under them. This is how you group them under Monorail. You put them in an area.
So if I'm doing a Northwind database and I want to go to the customers page and I want a grid with a bunch of customers, you know, so in ASP.NET, I go file new page, customer.aspx, I drag a data grid over, maybe a data source, select star from customers, bind to the data grid, and then I've got a bunch of stuff in a grid. How do I do that in Monorail?
Under Monorail, you'd probably just have a customer controller. And, you know, I don't know that the Northwind scenario is complicated enough to warrant, you know, a bunch of different areas.
What's a better one?
A real web application.
Okay, so you're tell me about your web application.
Well, in our situation, you know, we have a top level area, and then we've grouped our controllers into areas where, you know, specific to roles, you know, like for administrators would under this area, they would have a bunch of controllers related to, you know, tasks that they can carry out. You know, students, you know, they would have, their controllers would be under, you know, an area, you know, related to their tasks. It's very simple, just a way to organize the controllers, which are really the important part of, you know, Monorail.
So are controllers related directly to URIs, to URLs?
Yes.
Yeah, all three things I mentioned, areas, controllers, and actions are related to URLs. What Monorail does when it's parsing a URL is take the directories leading up to the last directory, the deepest directory, and that becomes the area. The deepest directory is the controller's name, and then the index.rails or manageUsers.rails or what have you is the action. So the thing with the .rails extension is the action. There's actually no file called usermanagement.rails. It doesn't exist. And so that action is essentially a method. I mean, it is a method that gets called on the controller. And
okay, so that's good. So then if in ASP.NET world, in my brain, I've got the grid for taking a test or adding some information about a student. Maybe I'm going to update student. So I'm on a student page. I'm going to change his name and hit update student. In ASP.NET, we do a post back. So we're doing an HTTP post with a bunch of control state, view state, and additional information that was on the page. We're going to post it back to our page. It's going to get picked up by the same page, and then we're going to fire some pseudo events on the server side. How does that whole postback process, it wouldn't be a postback process, but how does that I push the button process work for that same scenario in Monorail?
So in Monorail, you've got a lot of freedom, right? I mean, you can use AJAX, you can use a post, you can use a get, and you can use whatever you want to call an action. And so let's say your action is update user, and you're just changing the user's username. That's the only field you update. So you would do you'd create a form, and the form's action, its submit action, would be a post to update user.rails. And in the form parameters you have, in the form values, you have whatever you need to update the user.rails. And that would call the user.rails or the user action on the user management controller. And that action would then do what it needs to do. It would update the database, show an error if necessary, and then it would redirect or... So the other thing, I'll back up a bit. The other thing that's in Monorail that's important is views. So not only do you have your controller action and area, but what's shown to the user is a view. And by default, you have a one-to-one mapping between your actions and your views. So if you have index.rails, you'd have an index.vm or Braille or whatever view engine you're using. There's multiple view engines. But so we use Braille. So you'd have an index.braille, and that would be your HTML. It's just a simple template using the Boo language. And like I said, you can use nVelocity if you don't like Boo. But so you've got that gets rendered. And I can talk more about how things get rendered between, or how data gets passed from the controller to the view. But essentially, once you did the post in the to update user, it would send them back to the index.rails. So they would just redirect to index.rails.
I should mention that the form values that are posted are fed as arguments to to the action method. So, you know, very simply, if you're just doing username, you just have a string argument with the same name as the form value. And there are more complex ways to, you know, to bind, you know, there's a data bind system in Monorail that lets you do complex binding on, you know, transfer objects or, you know, other view objects that you may need to use to more express, you know, the data and all that kind of thing.
Okay. So within the context of ASP.NET, if I have a input name, you know, input type equals text, name equals foo, that's going to show up in whatever text box on the server side also has the name foo. So you have a similar kind of implicit binding based on name, but then also additional explicit bindings based on attribute or...
Well, it's always based on name. The method of binding is what varies. So the default binding would, you know, you would just have an action method that has a string username and an int user ID. You can do more complicated things like have a user object that's just a DTO, just a simple view object that has an ID and a name property. And then you would in your view, when you're referencing them on the form, you do user.id or user.name. And it would actually do that data binding behind the scenes so that you get a user object with those properties filled in. You can do even cooler things like if you're just referencing a user, like you can, instead of passing the ID in a DTO, you do what we do is called, like, what do we call it? Entity?
In the action method, one of the arguments is actually one of our in a Hibernate entities. And if there is a value in the form with the same name as that argument, and it is the primary key for that entity, then it will automatically, you know, do an in-Hibernate load and pass that in. So we never have to deal with these primary keys and, you know, passing all these identities around.
Now, is the use of in-Hibernate required or traditional within the context of Monorail?
It's not required. A lot of stuff's really optional. There's an inversion of control container. It's Monorail itself is part of a larger framework called Castle, and they have their own inversion of control container that you can use with Monorail. Its use is optional, which is something we don't quite like. We would like it to be mandatory. But there's a few other components that they push.
One of them is Active Record, and it's a framework built on top of nHibernate that allows you to, it's similar to the Active Record stuff in Ruby. It allows you to map to a database and just attribute your classes and say, you know, this property maps to that database field. And they've actually got an Active Record data binder like the one we wrote for just straight nHibernate that will allow you to get an Active Record entity as a query string parameter, even though it's actually only an ID in the query string.
So talk to me more about this inversion of control. This is they call it the Windsor container. I think that inversion of control might be something that a lot of people are not really familiar with. And how is that different than just like a service factory?
The main thing with inversion of control is when you're writing, you know, lots of code and you want to test that code, you want to unit test that code, lots of times a service will depend on other services. And, you know, inversion of control...
It's a good question, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you? I can just go foo. You know, foo a equals new foo. What's wrong with that?
Well, a lot of the time, foo is going to take, you know, a bar. So you'll be doing new foo, you know, passing a new bar in, and you know.
Well, to back up even more, that's not the traditional way. The traditional way is within foo's constructor, you instantiate a new bar, and so now foo has a bar, and foo is going to use bar to calculate foo bar, and it. If you want to test foo on its own, you cannot in C#. You can't do it because bar is already instantiated. It's always the same bar. If you want to mock bar, then you need to basically rewrite the class to accept bar as a constructor argument or as a
property. Or use like type mock.
Or you could use type mock. But that's a bit... of a heavy stick when compared to something that's already testable. And so, I mean, we use RhinoMox here. We're very happy with it. And if you're designing for testability, which I know some people disagree with, then you don't run into that problem. You don't have to use TypeMock to mock private methods, or everything's going to be accessible and testable.
Okay, so now bring it all back around to inversion of control.
So once you've got your foo class accepting a bar class, And more likely it's going to be accepting an IBAR interface so that you can more easily mock it. That way you're not tied to always having virtual methods. You can just do an interface. You mock the interface itself rather than the instance of the class. Once you have that, you run into things where, let's say, foo depends on bar, which depends on blah and yada. And then, so your instantiation would look like new foo, new bar, which takes new yada and new blah. And it's just, it just gets huge and unwieldy. And across a large system, it's even worse. So what an inversion of control framework does is allows you to take all of those things, all of those dependencies, and put them into one container. And then once they're in that container, you ask the container, hey, give me a foo. It's going to look at foo's constructor, realize that foo takes a bar. So it's going to instantiate a bar, but it's going to look at bar's constructor and realize that it takes a blah and a yada. And so it's going to instantiate blahs and yadas and put those into bar and then put that bar into foo. So what you get back is just a foo that has everything it needs. And if you want to test foo instead of asking the container for it, unless it's an auto mocking container, then you ask, you just instantiate one and pass it in mocks in the constructor.
So the resulting foo that's been created and all of the things within that dependency framework that the dependency injection framework has gleaned, these are all mocked versions. You've told the dependency framework, when I ask for a foo, I want those other three dependencies to be mocked, or?
So in the application itself, they're not mocked, obviously. They're full versions of it. In our testing framework, typically what we do is we just create the mocks and pass them into the constructors. The container does not enter into it. Jacob worked on something that we're kind of experimenting with. It's an auto-mocking container where you can ask the container for a real instance of foo, and it'll automatically instantiate mocks for each of the types that foo requires. It's pretty slick, and we haven't used it too much in practice. He just wrote it, we're probably going to start playing with it. We're concerned about performance a little, but it's not that heavy, because the main problem with containers, the main overhead is actually putting things into that container. And with the auto-mocking container, you don't actually put anything into it. It just infers for the one thing you're instantiating.
Okay, so I'm starting to get an idea of how this works. And is this easier to? This is obviously easier to test. It's easier to maintain.
Absolutely. I mean, with ASP.NET, one of the things you run into is an issue. The page lifecycle is complicated. I mean, there's a reason there's like tons of charts and books dedicated to just the page lifecycle.
Yeah, I helped write one of those. Thanks for that.
Well, that's no fault of. I mean, that's not your fault, right? You're helping people understand it, and that's good. So in Monorail, the page lifecycle is really easy. You get a method called. Your action is called. And you do things in that action. And the result of that action, you know, you've got your side effects, your database saves, what have you, or reads. And then you end up either redirecting them to a page or rendering a view within your controller. Or, I mean, essentially, it's always, you know, you're returning some sort of response. Usually it's a view.
So it sounds like because the views and the controllers are much more separate than they are in the terms of a markup and a code behind, that you can test this without bringing up a browser or using water or any kind of a browser automation framework, because you just make controllers and they don't really care what's going on.
Right.
Do they know about HTTP context? Because then I start getting into state, cookies, query. You know, when do you break the fourth wall and this beautiful thing starts crashing down because you've decided to reach into a cookie somewhere?
So with the controller has, you know, access to the response and the request. It can get cookies, it can get query string, it can get form values directly. Luckily, most of those things come in as parameters. You can actually make a cookie parameter and it'll take the value of that cookie. That bit us when we had we didn't know this. We had a locale query string parameter and a locale cookie with the same name, and we actually got an array of it. And so we learned that one the hard way, but it's pretty slick because, you know, you can just add a parameter for your cookie. If you want to access it directly, if you want to write a cookie, you do have access to the response and the request. They're all contained within the Rails engine context. And so part of the testability concerns is, how do you test cookies? How do you test response? And we've got some pretty creative ways to handle this. Out of the box, Monorail isn't as testable as we'd like. We've been working with Hamilton over at the Castle Project to kind of make it more testable. And essentially, in order to test it, you want to create a controller and you want to have complete access over the cookies. And so you want to essentially be able to mock that cookie collection. And by default, you don't have access to that. Hamilton just made a few methods that were previously internal public. And so you now have access to those. So you can now mock the entire Rails engine context.
So you keep saying cookie collection, but we're not talking necessarily about system.web.http cookie collection, are we? We're talking about a collection of cookies. I'm wondering how much system.web dependency there is in the controller itself.
iRails engine context, the default one, has iResponse and iRequest. You know, there's properties with those that return those values, and they have their own. Those are their own Monorail interfaces. They have adapters that wrap the HTTP context.current stuff, and that's how most of that stuff is done.
Yeah, we've had a lot of trouble trying to mock HTTP context, and I know that people really want to be able to basically test an entire web application without ever using the web to do it. And I've just decided that that's not possible. Kind of when I say decided, like until I decide otherwise. And we just basically use water. We automate IE. What better way to why mock when you can just integrate? Is kind of my perspective.
Well, the reason is we can develop our controllers, our code behind essentially in the ASP.NET world. We can develop that entirely using TDD. We can set up all of our responses, all of our expectations. We can set all of that up without ever running IIS. And the reason that's nice is because our tests, you know, run 1,000 tests per 30 seconds instead of the standard instantiating IIS and IE. And I mean, water tests are great and there's a place for them. I'm not saying that we get rid of them, but they really test the view, and that's what they should test and the end to end. So they should test, you know, that button appears and that I can click on that button. And then when I click on that button after, you know, a second, that a new page comes up. There's a place for that. But as far as just testing behavior, just testing that the controller asks the DAO factory for a user DAO and requests a user and then saves that user, just testing that is something that you should be able to do with unit tests, and you can with Monorail completely.
Do you have 1,000 tests?
We have over 3,000.
Rock on.
So what's the percentage of lines of code in tests versus not in tests?
The ratio.
That's a good question.
I don't know that off the top of my head.
We haven't. I mean, it's probably at least 50%, if not more, tests.
50% of the code that you've written is tests.
Yeah.
So it's 1 to 2 tests to code.
Yeah.
Cool. Rock on. What else are we missing? What else haven't we talked about? We're trying to make this accessible to the listener. So, you know, someone's listening. He's driving to work right now, and he works for the Nebraska Department of Forestry, and they use ASP.NET. How is he going to go and sell this to his boss? Does he just need to do it, tell his boss later that he did it using a non-standard thing? How do they get started? I mean, they can go, and they can download it, and they can fool around, but what's the best way for them to really grok what's going on in Monorail and decide whether it's right for their project?
So, I mean, the best way is really to just dive in and give it a shot. I mean, I mentioned that we used ASP.NET. We now are using both web forms and Monorail. And the reason is that we just don't have the time or resources to convert all of our web forms pages to Monorail, nor do we really need to. I mean, if they're working, they're working. We tried some model view presenters things with web forms, and that would allow us to better test the logic within a code behind. It wasn't as good as we wanted it to be, and so that's why we moved to Monorail. But I mean, you can completely run web forms and Monorail side by side. We have ASPX pages, we have .rails pages, they link to each other. We actually have a master page, and then Monorail has something called a layout, which is just a master page. And we maintain them both, as do we maintain two different navigation controls. It's kind of a headache. We would love to be rid of web forms, but because, I mean, that maintainability is more obnoxious. But, I mean, it was well worth the investment and the overhead.
Do you think that Monorail is kind of, I was going to say doomed, but I'll just say, is it going to be always relegated to an alternative lifestyle?
I hope not. I mean, it's I think ASP.NET and web forms is going to have to change. I mean, I think that there's got to be change in the wind. I mean, they've got to know that whole view state, the post back thing is great for demos. The drag and drop is like, it's really impressive. But when you try to write a real application with it, it kind of starts to break down and it's not as testable. It's not as maintainable. I think that with ASP.NET Ajax, I mean, Microsoft's kind of heading in the right direction. Hopefully some changes will happen, but with monorail, it's here to stay. I mean, and it's an alternative right now, but
is there any movement? I mean, you guys are using HTTP handlers, but so you're beholden to ASP.NET. This could certainly be an ISAPI extension. Is there any movement of getting out of the web.config file and somewhere else?
I don't know that there really needs to be. I mean, yet right now, especially in our scenario, since we're using both, like it makes sense to use both. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff in system.web that is useful. I mean, we still use the membership provider. Like we use, that to log in and to create, do we still use it to create users?
No.
Okay. We just use it to log in. But we still use it. And so, I mean, there are useful things there. It's not a wash.
Cool. I'm sure Scott Guthrie will be happy to hear that when he listens to this podcast. Guys, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, and hopefully I'll start digging a little bit more. I know that Monorail is just one part of the Castle project, and I know that I've given the Castle project a cursory glance in the past, and I'll have to pay a little more attention to it now. Thanks for taking the time.
No problem.
Thank you.